It is Friday, December 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump's former personal attorney says the president has not been truthful about Russia and other matters. We get some reaction.
When Cohen actually met with the publisher of the National Enquirer, and this was the crime in which he pled guilty, the president was in the room.
French police kill a suspect they believe was responsible for the deadly attack at the Strasbourg Christmas market, and a new Mary Poppins film delights holiday viewers. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, said Friday he believes the president is not telling the truth about his campaign's involvement with Russia. Cohen was sentenced Wednesday to 3 years in prison, in part for helping make payments to two women who alleged they had affairs with Trump to stay silent before the 2016 election. In an interview on ABC's Good Morning America, Cohen responded no when asked if Trump was telling the truth to special counsel Robert Mueller about everything related to Russia. Cohen said he bought the silence of the women because Trump was very concerned about how this would affect the election if the allegations were made public. Deputy White House Press Secretary Hogan Gidley dismissed Cohen's interview when asked by reporters at the White House Friday. He said the fact that the media is giving credence to a convicted criminal, you're giving credence to someone who's a self-admitted liar. Gidley also said for him to say, I'm going to stop lying now, is somewhat silly. Trump has contended the hush money payments were not criminal. He told Fox News earlier this week the charges were brought by prosecutors, in his words, to embarrass me. I never directed him to do anything incorrect or wrong. New York prosecutors say then-candidate Trump was involved in making a $150,000 payment to one of the women through American Media Incorporated. The company owns the supermarket tabloid National Enquirer. With a growing number of investigations against Trump and his associates and guilty pleas from his former national security advisor, former campaign chair, and former personal attorney, there seems to be a sense that the president may not be able to escape all of it unscathed. International Edition's Lori London talks to criminal defense attorney Jack Rice.
You know, one of the difficulties that President Trump has right now is that the Russia investigation has continued to move forward, and it gets broader and broader, and the net gets broader and broader, because the more information that you have, the more it connects various different kinds of dots. And so more people get pulled into that net as you go, and the more of an investigation that you have, the more relevant information that you can acquire. And you also have a long history of other information that you already have in your possession. So when you look at where we are right now, we look at Michael Flynn. The fact that he has been cooperating is a huge deal. And by the way, suggesting that he should do no time says the kind of information that General Flynn has been giving to the Mueller investigation says that it has value. Just because he has something, if he can't help, sometimes you get nothing for it. Now, if you think about Cohen, Cohen, too, the recommendation in this case was 3 years. The 3 years that he's going to do, you still are seeing cooperation when it comes to that issue. The real story that's out there right now is the cooperation of the publisher from the National Enquirer. The reason that's particularly important is because when Cohen actually met with the publisher of the National Enquirer, and this was the crime in which he pled guilty, the president was in the room. The president doesn't have to say anything because Cohen actually works for him, which means the president was aware of a crime being committed. He was aware of the activity itself. And that in itself is enough to pull the trigger for an indictment. And the question is how this will work while a sitting president actually does what he does and how the Justice Department does what he does. The real issue here, though, is that you're actually seeing information coming from two sides of the same incident, and the only person who isn't in agreement, at least at this point, is the president himself. They both say, yeah, a crime was being committed. We knew it. We were both there. Oh, and the third guy, yeah, he's in the Oval Office. If there is a time to sweat, this is it.
So is it possible that the Russia investigation won't be the actual thing that does the most harm to this president or causes him the most legal problems?
Well, let's take a look at Bill Clinton. It started out with Whitewater, which was a real estate investigation. And it turned out that it was actually about him lying under oath and a blue dress. It's strange how that works, but one of the things that happens in federal investigations, and one of the easiest things to prosecute, is obstruction. One of the second easiest things to prosecute is lying to the FBI. So when you start looking at that, sometimes it's not shocking that you go for the low-hanging fruit. In this case, it's the easy prosecution because you have more and more information. And of course, the president just answered a whole bunch of questions. And when he answers questions and the Mueller investigation knows a whole lot more about what's going on than probably the president does, you really potentially open yourself up to something particularly interesting.
The president did an interview with Fox News on Thursday. And he said that, you know, he didn't even think there was any payment to the National Enquirer for any of this. So, therefore, it was really nothing. And he also downplayed his relationship with Michael Cohen and Michael Cohen's position.
I think it's very clear at this point that there was a longstanding relationship with Michael Cohen and Donald Trump that goes long before he decided to run for the presidency. And there is lots and lots and lots of documentation that establishes that. This argument that he didn't know anything about the money being involved. The problem is when you're getting cooperation from all sides except him, every time he makes a statement, and if he's prepared to sit down and tell the FBI that, and you're going to get contradiction from those other two sources, that in itself is a crime. That in itself can put you in jail. And in fact, if you look at somebody like a Papadopoulos, he was the man who actually pled guilty earlier. One of the reasons he pled guilty was because he lied to the FBI. It wasn't even about content. It was about honesty. And that in itself is a crime, and that's something the president potentially faces. So this may work well and good for Fox News. This may work well and good for Twitter, but that doesn't particularly play when you're talking with the Department of Justice.
Just to sum this all up, how much trouble overall do you think this president is in, and can he survive all of this through an entire first term?
Here is the shift that seems to be taking place right now. What we are seeing is people who were standing by the president previously are starting to flip, and they're starting to cooperate with the Russia investigation. And that has to be disconcerting to this president because you can't hide from that. In addition to that, what you are also seeing here is, I think, a political flip, even within the party themselves, where Republicans are starting to look at what's going on with this White House, and they're starting to assess whether or not he's helpful to them. Now, it sounds crazy that that's going to be an issue that matters in a criminal investigation, but it does. Because in this case, if you're talking about impeachment, and that's one of the questions that's out there, that is a political question, not a criminal question. And a willingness in the past to not look at it, to ignore it, is something that I think you're starting to see a shift on right now. And a willingness to actually say, well, let's talk about it, and well, on the Republican side of the aisle, not being afraid of this president. It's about more than just getting the support of those on the left who want to get this president. It's about handing this to everybody else and say, this is fundamentally wrong and something that's fundamentally unacceptable to us as a people, regardless of political affiliation. And I think that's something that's a very smart approach to take, because you need sort of the collective support of this, because this is continuing to create this schism in the country, and I think everybody knows it.
Criminal defense attorney Jack Rice speaking with International Edition's Lori London. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. U.S.-backed fighters are battling the Islamic State in its last Syrian stronghold. A 7-year-old child dies in the custody of the U.S. Border Patrol. An anti-insurgency raid reportedly harms Afghan civilians. And China denies linking its detention of two Canadians to the Meng Wanzhou case. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
We know that certain colors can influence how a food product should taste. Like when we're about to drink a yellow-colored beverage, many of us probably think we're about to taste something tart like lemonade. Penn State University researchers Molly Higgins and John Hayes wanted to find out how people learn to associate colors with tastes and whether they could be taught to link colors with completely different tastes. Over four sessions, the researchers got subjects to sip liquids with new colors they had specifically selected, avoiding any preconceived color taste pairings. Then the subjects were given uncolored liquids and were asked to pair each flavor with the new colors. It turns out the subjects picked the correct color taste match 59% of the time. The research will be published in the journal Food Quality and Preference. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look back at the career of the late singer Nancy Wilson. A day after killing the alleged assailant in a bloody Christmas market shooting in eastern France, police are searching for other potential suspects. The Islamic State group, without providing evidence, claim responsibility for Tuesday's attack that killed four people, wounded more than a dozen others, and left a country on edge. Lisa Bryant has more for VOA.
Public prosecutor Rémy Heitz on Friday detailed the two-day manhunt that led to police shooting dead Sherif Chekat in the Strasbourg neighborhood where he grew up.
C'est comme je vous l'ai dit, une patrouille de police qui a remarqué à 21h.
Heitz said two witnesses tipped off police after seeing a man who matched a widely circulated description of Chekat during a manhunt that included nearby Germany. Around 9 p.m. local time Thursday, a police patrol spotted a man trying to enter a building and identified themselves. The man turned around and opened fire, at which point police responded, killing him.
L'enquête va désormais se poursuivre. Afin d'identifier d'éventuels complices ou co-auteurs.
Heitz said the terrorist investigation continues to identify possible suspects in Tuesday's Christmas market shooting. Police have detained more than half a dozen people for questioning, including four members of Chekat's family.
Ça n'est pas la revendication totalement opportuniste de Daesh.
The Islamic State group said Chekat was one of its so-called soldiers. But visiting the newly reopened market on Friday, French Interior Minister Christophe Castaner dismissed the claim as totally opportunistic, saying Chekat nourished evil within himself. A Strasbourg native with Moroccan roots, Chekat had an extensive criminal record that stretched to Germany and Switzerland and multiple prison sentences. He had been on a French watch list for suspected Islamist views.
Je sais qu'il est mort. Et je n'ai plus à me dire, est-ce qu'il est derrière moi ou caché dans un coin?
Strasbourg's businesses have taken a major hit. Still, many locals said they were relieved Chekat had been killed. One woman told French radio she had been haunted by fears of him still hiding and ready to strike, but that the burden has been lifted. The police have been hailed as heroes for tracking down Chekat as swiftly as they did, but their representatives say officers are exhausted after also dealing with multiple French anti-government protests in recent weeks. Some of the demonstrators say they'll be back on the streets to protest government reforms and the high cost of living. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Human Rights Watch this week called on Chinese authorities to immediately release Pastor Wang Yi and members of his unregistered or underground Early Rain Covenant Church. They were taken into custody last Sunday in the southwest city of Chengdu. The rights group said the shutdown of the Protestant church epitomizes what it called President Xi Jinping's relentless assault on religious freedom in China. It said the church, which includes a kindergarten, offices, seminary, and Bible college, were ransacked and sealed, private homes searched, and some members beaten. Wang Yi and his wife were charged with inciting subversion of state power. The rights group described the pastor as an outspoken critic of the Chinese Communist Party. Ian Johnson is a Beijing-based writer for such publications as the New York Times and has authored the book The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao, a reference to China's Communist Party founder Mao Zedong. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Beijing embarked on a crackdown on religious groups 2 years ago with new regulations that tighten control of religious life.
There is this religious revival going on in China, And to some degree, the government thinks that it can be useful for the government as a way of building values and binding people together in society. But on the other hand, they're worried that religion can become a force that's outside of government control. So they have these new regulations in place and have been slowly tightening the screws on groups that are not registered with the government, that are independent of government control. And this is probably the most prominent church in China that is not registered with the government. And so it was almost just a matter of time before they went after it.
What happens to these people once they're detained? Are they kept incarcerated for a long period of time?
Most of them are detained for 24 hours. The police has the right to detain people for 24 hours. There have been some reports and photos that have been circulated on social media that seem to show that people were roughed up a bit. And basically, they're meant to be scared a little bit and then released. And then the government will, however, go after the leaders of the church. Wang Yi, to my knowledge, is still in detention. The elders of the church, and those that run the church, a couple of them are still in detention. A couple of others have been released but are under house arrest. Well, I don't know if they'll jail them formally, arrest them and try them, but they could be put under house arrest. There's been precedent for this before where people are essentially held under house arrest for years and years.
By one account, more than 100,000 Chinese Christians have been detained this year, more than three times as many as last year.
Yes, this is part of the overall crackdown on religious groups that the government is worried about. The government sees some religions as potentially useful allies. In a way, you could think of it as analogous to Vladimir Putin's Russia, where he's embraced the Orthodox Church, and the Orthodox Church, to some degree, has embraced Putin, and it's sort of a pillar of his support. The Chinese Communist Party, although it's called a Communist Party, it's supposed to be atheist. In fact, it's sort of similar to Putin's Russia in that it sees some religions like Buddhism, Taoism, folk religions as being useful, and other religions like Christianity and Islam as more problematic, potential enemies or challengers. And so they're going hard after these groups.
Despite persecution, according to the Associated Press, Christianity continues to grow rapidly in China. The AP said Chinese Christian numbers rival the membership of the ruling Communist Party, now at 90 million.
That could be, yeah. There are different estimates for the number of Christians in China. It could be as high as 90 million. I take a slightly lower number. Of course, we shouldn't compare them completely. It's a little bit of apples and oranges because the Communist Party is a highly disciplined, centrally controlled party, whereas the Christians are spread among thousands and thousands of churches spread across the country and not organized under one leader. But yeah, I mean, it is an interesting way to think about it, that there are a lot of Christians in China, that Christianity was really small when the communists took over in 1949. There were only 1 million Protestants, and now there are tens and tens of millions, maybe, you know, up to 100 if you include the Catholics. So it shows that Christianity has grown and that it satisfies something that people feel lacking in their life.
Ian Johnson said the crackdown has been far more severe in rest of northwest Xinjiang territory, where more than 1 million ethnic Muslims holding what are called strong religious views have been sent to so-called re-education camps, prompting international calls for access to them. China said the camps protect the country from terrorism while providing vocational training. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. A new edition of the Mary Poppins story, Mary Poppins Returns, opens in theaters just in time for the holidays. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, at the film's London premiere, many of the stars, including lead actress Emily Blunt, said the world could use a little Mary Poppins magic.
I was flying the kite and I got caught on a nanny!
Mary?
Poppins, you came back.
You seem hardly to have aged at all.
Really? One never discusses a woman's age, Michael. Would have hoped I taught you better.
Emily Blunt takes on the role of the strict but kind nanny Mary Poppins in Mary Poppins Returns. Blunt takes over the role, which earned Julie Andrews an Oscar more than 50 years ago. In the new film from Disney, Mary Poppins is visiting the now-grown Michael and Jane Banks in a particular time of need. The new film is set in Depression-era London, 20 years after Mary's original appearance. This time, Michael Banks and his three children have suffered a tragedy, the loss of their wife and mother. At the London premiere, Emily Blunt said she thinks that Mary Poppins has a particular role in our world.
Bring order to chaos, I don't know. I think probably rather a lot. I think that's why she has a lot of relevance for people around the world when things feel rather fragile. I think that she's a great unifier, you know.
Blunt's co-star, award-winning writer and actor Lin-Manuel Miranda, said that Mary Poppins brings something the world needs, hope.
Boy, Mary Poppins, like, not a moment too soon, am I right? I mean, Mary Poppins doesn't come along when everything's okay. Mary Poppins comes along when there's trouble, and I feel like the world is in a scary time, and so it feels like a movie the world needs right now.
Emily Mortimer plays the grown-up Jane Banks. She says it was ironic that the premiere took place at a time of crisis in the British government over Brexit.
I think we all need a dose of Mary Poppins. I think that she's a mind bender. That's her particular art. She helps people see things from a new perspective. And I think that both in America and in Britain, we all need help seeing things in a new perspective. And hopefully that will bring some unity.
Writer-director Rob Marshall says he knew that Emily Blunt was the right person for the role from the very beginning.
Honestly, she was the first and only person I thought of for the role. And I think it's because we had just finished working with her on Into the Woods, and it was very clear to us that the huge demands of this role, she filled every single one of them. With her humor, with her singing voice, with her great acting ability, the layers that she plays as an actress.
Blunt, who has been nominated for 2 Screen Actors Guild Awards, one of them for Mary Poppins, says she hopes that years from now, audiences will be singing the songs from her film, just as they do from the original.
Well, I hope that generations to come will sing these songs. I think they're gorgeous. I think they're catchy and wonderful and will have the same imprint on people, you know.
Mary Poppins Returns also stars Ben Whishaw as Michael Banks, Oscar winners Meryl Streep as Mary's cousin Topsy and Colin Firth as Wilkins, and Dick Van Dyke, whom fans remember as Chimney Sweep Bert and Mr. Dawes Sr. in the original, makes an appearance as Mr. Dawes Jr. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Thank you, David. Well, Grammy-winning jazz and pop singer and sometime actress Nancy Wilson has died at the age of 81. Her manager and publicist say she died peacefully at her home in California after a long illness. Wilson came to fame in the 1960s and called herself a song stylist, resisting attempts to label her as a jazz singer for most of her career, as she could cross many genres. Wilson's How Glad I Am earned her a Grammy in 1965 for Best R&B Recording.
My love has no beginning, my love has no end. No front or back, and my love won't bend. I'm in the middle, lost in spin, loving you. And you don't know, you don't know, you don't know, you don't know.
Nancy Wilson received a Grammy in 2004 for Lifetime Achievement and the Jazz Master's Fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, a A music critic once called Wilson the heir apparent to iconic jazz singer Ella Fitzgerald, and she was influenced by Nat King Cole and other legendary vocalists. She retired from recording in 2011. Well, that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.